Everybody, and welcome to the PC Gamer Show for January 17th, 2018. 20 great teen.
20 great teen.
20 great
teen. Is that what we're saying?
Yes, that's the new thing.
All right.
Wes last week was trying to turn it 2018. Was it you?
This is a callback from last week.
Yeah. We have recurring gags and recurring themes.
I'm not used to this positive, optimistic James.
Yeah, who are you?
It's strange.
Well, I don't know. It's just that now that I have been in control of topics for a long time, we don't have to talk about CCGs very often. So it's like, and when Bo talks about Overwatch, it's like just compact and precise and just delivered, and it's here and gone. So I don't really have anything to be too upset about. I like Overwatch. I was watching a lot of Overwatch League this last
week. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's been very cool. I think it's still incredibly hard to parse for the average viewer, but it's pretty neat. Well, hey, I should introduce ourselves before we...
Who are we?
Who are we? That's a deep question. Bo, who are you?
I'm Bo. Hello. Oh, our names are like totally swapped. That's not right.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. Yeah, let's switch here.
All right.
I'm sorry, guys.
Let's do it.
We deceived you.
A little shuffle up.
We deceived you.
We should have just switched personalities.
Yeah, that would have been way more efficient.
I'm Bo. I love Overwatch and raw denim and bacon.
That's true. That's like extremely accurate.
That's Bo.
That's me.
You may have now noticed that I'm twice the size I was a moment ago.
Bo is tiny
Bo
now.
Is much smaller.
Oh my god, I'm so small. We got this.
We're using a pretty wide angle.
Yeah.
I feel absurd now.
Still nailing down this whole studio. We got lights now. The table's looking good. I can control OBS from here, so it's gonna be a smoother show. Knock on wood.
Do you want to introduce our fourth guest?
Who is our fourth guest?
Well, who are you?
Fourth table member. I'm Wes, not Bo.
You're not Bo. Okay.
Features editor. I'm James Davenport, associate editor. But here,
who's this?
Who's this guy? This
is lurking in the corner.
It's our little mascot, Coconut Monkey.
What's up, Coconut
I'm not
Monkey?
Grabbing Coconut Monkey. This is totally.
He just stood up on his own.
Stood up on his own.
He's a little shy. He's hiding again.
A little shy. Cannot speak.
Has he sort of glares over the logo.
Just kind of a menacing presence.
Piercing eyes, though.
Yeah, beautiful blue piercing eyes, I might add, and a nice hairdo.
His hair is so gross.
We're gonna bring back Coconut Monkey. It's gonna be regular on the show, so expect to see a lot more Coconut Monkey. You can also see Coconut Monkey. I don't know if you guys saw this, but our emails went out today to our club members. What's it called? Rising Storm 2. You can now have PC Gamer exclusive decals and items, and there's a Coconut Monkey arm tattoo.
Nice. No shit, I missed that one.
Yeah. Along with a tub. No Geralt in there, but there's a tub tattoo and a pretty cool helmet that says "Make Mods, Not War." I like it a lot. So yeah,
shout out to Tripwire for that.
Yeah, thanks for
really cool stuff
working with us. That was really
I did
cool.
not know about the Coconut Monkey. That's
there's also awesome. An Elite skin. I haven't seen the Elite skin, but that's rad. So PC Gamer Club, club.pcgamer.com. I won't stay on this too long, but we're offering in-game items now for some stuff, so that's pretty cool. Anyway. There's a lot to talk about this week.
Is there?
No, there's not a lot.
Really not. We're barely into this year.
Yeah, we haven't been playing a lot.
This is going to be the stretch.
Yeah, not a ton of news this week. There's been some interesting things, but as far as like games, important, big, groundbreaking games news, it's relatively quiet.
I feel like either it's much quieter than last year or our gauge has just shifted a little bit. Because I think maybe due to the console cycle, the first few years, a lot of games were kind of ambitious about hitting the holiday time frame and ended up getting pushed into January, February, March. I feel like this year that hasn't really happened so much. I think like so many games, big games, good games came out in 2017 that this first like 3 months of the year relatively quiet.
It's quiet. I mean, what's the first big one? Monster Hunter is on PS4 and like end of next week.
And Dragon Ball FighterZ, those are both out like end of next week.
Right.
But only Dragon Ball for PC. Monster Hunter's a ways
the next
off.
Relatively big PC game I think is Far Cry 5, which is end of March. I mean, like majors. Sorry, like tentpole release.
It seems like all the tentpoles, they kind of hit their holiday release window for once, and didn't get pushed into March, and the March stuff get pushed into summer.
Still a lot of good games. Kingdom Come Deliverance, and like you mentioned, Ni No Kuni 2, is that soon?
That's, you know, they had to delay that game a few times. I don't remember when it's coming now, but it's not till like April at least.
I haven't been paying too much attention to like what's in that game because I think it's going to be one of the big JRPGs I play.
You've played a little of it at preview events,
Events, and like I wasn't in love with the combat, but it feels like it's hard to really get to grips with like a JRPG combat system in a 20-minute demo.
For sure.
Because you have not been fucking with the skills, and you know, they're not going to throw you at the hardest enemy that requires like deep tactics. But I remember seeing a headline, and I had no idea this was in the game, something like there's RTS battles in that game of some kind, or like mini RTS mechanics, or like grand, I don't know. It sounds like a big weird thing. Sure.
It's gonna have a lot going on, I think. I mean, the first game was basically like a Pokemon kind of battle system where you would like recruit little monsters and and have them fight with you, and you would do that more than using your own character, I think. And this one, they got rid of that mechanic, but they have new stuff to take its place.
That's true. Before we move on, I guess we're just talking about games coming out this year now, but early this year. Aquamanly mentioned that Final Fantasy XII port is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Would you know the date for that? It's pretty soon.
It's February 1st, I believe.
Damn, so that's right around the corner. And then we got a date for Final Fantasy XV.
A month later.
Which,
so, you know, in a way, those are big games. They're significant, but they're also ports.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like new releases kind of hitting in this quarter, you know, but first time for PC, so
plenty of stuff to play, no shortage of things to play, and I'm glad, like, from an archival standpoint, like all the Final Fantasy games are like gonna be on PC,
almost every single one at this point, except Final Fantasy Tactics.
That's Square, what the fuck,
come on, what are you doing?
It's got to be in the works.
Just come on,
we've asked for it enough
put
times.
It on the computer. Hack some mouse support into it, please.
Let's do it. You know what I picked up, but I guess we'll move into now playing. But this doesn't really count because I think before the show I asked, have you guys been playing anything? And
kind of haven't.
Not really.
In the show notes, James just wrote nothing in all caps.
But I touched briefly, and Wes has been trying to get me to play it for a long time. Is it Final Fantasy IX, the one you love a lot?
Yes.
Yeah, so I have that on PC, and I've been meaning to play that. And I booted it up and like did the opening like 15 minutes maybe.
Has a very charming opening.
Oh yeah!
Did you make it to the forest or
no? Okay. I barely opened it up, but I just brief first in, like impressions. I love the world, the art, and I feel like I don't know. You don't really see that kind of almost more fairy tale or cartoonish stuff in the mainline Final Fantasy series anymore.
Nope. And
it's like the whimsy is sort of gone.
It was a deliberate kind of throwback to, even at the time, to their like SNES games and their and the earlier games that were set in these fantasy settings that had a lot of these kind of classic like medieval trappings but with their own twist on it, you know, and that that is what Nine is. And they've done that a little in like some of the, you know, the spin-offs or the handheld games since then, but the mainline games have veered much more towards either sci-fi or like Final Fantasy XII is like the medieval aesthetic, but it's a much kind of more grown up like political story instead of this kind of like whimsy fairy tale like you said. So
either way, like I'm just like, I don't know, I think it might be one I chip away at like over the course of an entire year.
I actually talked Bo into playing it years ago.
We played it together.
We played it together and did sort of like a back and forth. We talked thought about doing like an article letter series about it, which we never ended up doing, but we just chatted a ton while we played it.
Because that one, Nine, was the final, like I loved, like FF7 is one of my all-time favorite games, and I had kind of bounced off of Nine when I first played it. I probably played like half or two-thirds or something and just sort of fizzled out and wasn't super into it at the time. And yeah, Wes convinced me to go back and replay it, and it definitely is really good.
It's a lot of fun.
Cool.
One you should definitely play on, if you're playing it on PC, I recommend playing it on a laptop, or it has very minimal system requirements. Mm-hmm. I recommend playing it on something on a smallish screen, because unfortunately they didn't have the original assets for the backgrounds, yeah. or if they exist, maybe they exist somewhere on a server, but they're kind of the, like, the popular fan theory is that those files were lost years and years ago. But so the port is not like an HD remaster or something. It's
right.
They up-resed the 3D models, so the 3D models look pretty good, even though they're the same geometry and stuff that they used to be. Those look pretty good. The backgrounds don't look so good, because it's literally like either a JPEG or a full... Some of them are actually videos, because they have lots of animation and stuff in the backgrounds. And so picture a video made for the PlayStation 1 that's like, you know, 240i interlaced video that has then been blown up to fit, you know, a 1080 or above screen, they can look really fuzzy. So it's a great thing if you have, like, just an integrated graphics laptop, like a Dell XPS 13, which is what I have. You can play it on that, and playing it on a much, much smaller screen, it looks a lot nicer.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, that was one thing I noticed, is backgrounds look, those 3D characters, perfect anti-aliasing on them stands out pretty hard against...
Yeah, it did not feel that discordant in the original game, because everything was
playing on a fuzzy
similarly
CRT.
Detailed. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, cool. Otherwise, like, I guess I'll continue with what I've been playing, but nothing. I did, like, half of another case in Danganronpa, and I'm enjoying it, but I also hate that I have to play it. I want to install it on a laptop or something so I can just, on the go, just open it up and, you know, move a scene forward, because I hate, like, sitting down at my PC and playing that is, it's a little... too much of a commitment, and it feels like too much of a thing for that, like, I'm kind of casually scrolling through half the time.
I don't think I would have played through a visual novel if I had to be sitting at my desk the whole time.
Yeah, they were perfect for, like, portable systems back when, so, you know, I think maybe if I can... I think it maybe works on a Mac. I have a MacBook, I'm sorry, guys, that I can maybe get it working on, but yeah, I'm a monster. That's pretty much it for me until Metal Gear Survive, which I'll get to in a bit, but you guys been playing anything else?
There was a while there where I wasn't playing Overwatch, believe it or not.
Whoa.
And I'm getting back into it.
Okay.
Partially because of the Overwatch League, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I actually went to a viewing party
over
the weekend for the San Francisco Shock.
Yeah, go Shock.
It was pretty cool. Like, two of their players were there, the two players who were, like, 17 and not old enough to be on the team yet officially. Or they're on the team, but they're not old enough to compete. But, like, so they were there for, like, a Q&A and a... like, signing thing. There was a lot of people. It was really cool. Had the games up on the big screen, and it's really fun.
How often are the individual teams going to be playing? Like, is Shock playing every week, or is it less frequent?
I believe so, yeah. It's the schedule. They have, like, it's like week one, week two, week three, and it seems, from what I can tell, each team plays two matches a week. So there's games on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And so, for example, this week, I think the Shock are playing Wednesday and Saturday. Each match, there's, like, four matches a day. Each match is four maps. So they play, like, one control point, one assault, one escort, and one hybrid. So, like, one of the each four game types. And it's like a best of four, weirdly, out of those four. Or they play all four of them.
Right.
So you either win 4-0 or 3. Sometimes they draw and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. So I haven't really followed along how the, like, point tallies carry over the course of the season.
Yeah.
But I guess you end up with a point score at some point over the thing. I'm not sure if your individual performance map by map, like, matters versus Packers, your like just your win-loss record for which maps or even whether you just win or lose, you know.
Yeah, I gotta say, like, production on those is really nice.
Yeah, the everything from, like, the Blizzard Esports Arena in LA, where all the matches are actually taking place and you can go and attend these in person, to then obviously they're now being broadcast on Twitch to some pretty insane viewer numbers. I think there was, like, almost 400K or so at peak, and averaging a solid 200,000 or so is what it seemed like.
That's almost as many people as watch our show every week.
Yeah, just so many. So obviously very popular. The biggest thing still that's like a thought in all of our minds is for the people who are not super versed in Overwatch, it's very difficult to watch. Even for people who play a lot of Overwatch, it's sometimes still like hard to parse what's going on and really figure it out.
I mean, I've played probably 20 or 30 hours of Overwatch and spent a few minutes, I was talking about this earlier, watching the streams, and I don't know, watching an FPS like Overwatch from the first person perspective doesn't do a lot for me. Mm-hmm. Compared to something like Counter-Strike, where I guess the simplicity of Counter-Strike is in the structure of it. You know, there's a lot of like deep tactics going on in the game, but all you have to be able like visually to understand pretty much is when they shoot the other guy or or like their path through the level, all of which is pretty easy to figure out after watching it a bit. And Overwatch has so many different abilities going off at different times that when you switch between players, that can be very disorienting, even when you have this sort of zoomed out, bird's eye view, which you'll switch to sometimes. You'll just see just green and pink lasers flying all over the place and abilities popping off. And you can, even if you can follow what those abilities are, it's really hard to follow the significance of what's happening.
Yeah, my pet peeve so far has been like anytime they follow a Genji player.
Yeah.
And anytime a Genji player like pulls off some big player or pops their ult, the caster starts screaming and getting excited, and then the first person camera is just nonsense.
I had that with a Tracer.
Yeah, Tracer's like, a bad one too.
I turned into a stream, and like the first thing was a Tracer that they sat on for like 30 seconds, and I was like seasick watching this person play.
That's the thing is like I think that the third person view tells the viewer a lot more because you can see like the flow of battle and what's happening and you get a better sense. But then like the first person view really shows like the mechanical skill of what these players are doing. And for better or worse, they spend most of their time on the DPS players because those are the ones getting the kills and doing the, having the most exciting moments. But like you said, Genji and Tracer, two of the most popular DPS heroes, are so fast jumping around. They're often, not only moving their character position very quickly, but also spinning their camera around very quickly. That is extremely disorienting to even if you're a Genji or Tracer player yourself. I found that sometimes when they spend some time on a Widow and you see your Widow like making a couple sniper shots, like that's pretty easy to follow. You know what you're looking for there. And I feel like that's kind of similar to
that's like relief. Strike. Like, okay, we got a few seconds of sniping.
Watching the
relax.
Yeah. Like you see that, but I'd really like to see them spend more time like on the tanks, like maybe like on a Reinhardt or somebody like in third person, like sitting there
on my character. Well, that
not,
I like
not just
play.
That, just like, I feel because the tanks often they, control the flow of battle.
They are much more about positioning than attacking.
And I think that would give a nice balance of seeing the full flow of the battle, but not be so caught up in jumping around like crazy.
I will say that I think it's about as good a job or first punch you can have for this kind of thing. And I don't know, the conversation about like how difficult or simple it is to parse what's happening on screen is like almost besides the point for me, because the Overwatch audience is massive, and if you can get like a portion of that audience to be like into this and consistently into this and know that they are able to understand or at least follow enough what's going on, then that's probably fine. I'm sure like it would be ideal for this to grow beyond even people who play the game. But
yeah, I think that's one of the big goals of having cities as your anchors, right? Is so many sports fans are a fan of the team from their just from wherever they live. You could potentially have that work with Overwatch as well. Is just
it's definitely worked for me so far. Like I'm rooting for if all of these teams were just like team names instead of cities, like I wouldn't know which one to pick. Like, I guess I would pick whichever one is the best, or I would, you know, some people like congregate to the best team. Some people choose like to choose an underdog team or whatever. But it's very weird when you choose your team versus like having a reason to root for them.
I mean, most people probably gravitate towards players that they
know
something about.
If you know something about those players, then you gravitate to them. So, but yeah, like it's been really cool for me, like not having a lot of allegiance to any one particular player, to see like, oh, like this is my team. I can.
Yeah, and like them. I think whether the audience expands to people who don't watch Overwatch or play Overwatch or not. Just having them based on a city, like I can reasonably expect, maybe San Francisco is an exception because there's so many like nerds here, but like I can reasonably expect to like just wander the city and run into someone wearing shock gear or like,
yeah, who, I've already seen it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I've seen it happen.
So, I mean, and that to me is like is enough, mm-hmm. of like a sense of camaraderie and, you know, something to root for immediately rather than like, yeah, having to parse these weird ass names and sponsorships and, yeah, you know.
And that's the thing is, even if you can't follow it live,
yeah,
there are still like replays and recaps, yes, being produced that maybe if you care about how the team does, but you don't want to follow, you know, even if you only watch your own team's games, that's like an hour twice a week or, yeah, something, which is not a huge commitment, but still, like, depending on your times or whatever, it may be hard to watch every single game.
I mean, that's roughly comparable to a football game a week.
It's true, yeah, and that's, it's not an unreasonable amount of time to expect somebody to follow. I you know, I think that also it helps people to be able to get into it, knowing, oh, if I want to follow this one team, I only have to watch 2 hours a week, versus like if you want to just follow Overwatch League, like,
it's overwhelming, right?
You're like watching 16 hours a week. That's way too much.
Yeah. I think that's been a difficult thing for esports in general, is there are so often tournaments that even if you pick your one game, your League of Legends or something, there's going to be tournaments all the time, mm-hmm. that a lot of teams are playing in, just hours and hours and hours of games. And even if you're only following one or two teams, I think the frequency of that can quickly, if you're not really devoted to it, you know, burn, yeah, you out, or just be like, yeah, a really huge commitment.
And similarly with the irregularity of those game lengths, you would sometimes, even if you were trying to follow one specific team or player or something, it would be a lot more difficult to follow them. You would know that, like, okay, this tournament is happening for 7 hours today and my team is going to play at some point,
right,
throughout
this.
Right, it
could be 2.5 hours in or 4 hours,
yeah,
in, depending on
the match. Yeah, you don't really know. So you end up basically having to watch the whole thing, whereas this, like, they've done a really good job of schedule, I guess, thankfully, to knowing about how long these games take and then buffering it with the right amount of commentary in between, that they have a pretty set schedule that, like, this will happen at 4 p.m., 5 p.m., 6 p.m., 7 p.m., or whatever the numbers are. And yeah, so you know, like, okay, the San Francisco Shock match is going to happen at 9 p.m. on Friday. Like, I can plan to watch that, very much as, you know that the Giants baseball game is going to happen at 2:30, mm-hmm. on Sunday, mm-hmm. or even if it's an all day of baseball and, you know, there's a bunch of games, like, you know when your one game is going to be.
In a few years, I would love to see someone do sort of a history of the development of how esports is essentially broadcast, presented, like, comparable to the history of sports, the way the, yeah, cameras change. And, like, if you watch baseball, you get now they really frequently kind of show you the strike zone and where where the pitch goes. In football, you have the cameras hanging over the field that track, you know, along, yeah, with the players, and they give you the kind of that overlay, like, of where the first down line is, yeah, that, yeah, kind of stuff. Like, and I'm sure esports has those mechanics now, but, like, what are they going to be 10 years from now as they figure out better ways to show off these games?
We got to move on quickly, but what's interesting is, like, aside, I don't really watch sports, but I turned on some football the other day just to have something in the background. And
did it trigger any high school memories for you?
Oh, definitely. But the camera tech they have is, it almost feels like a video game. I thought I was watching Madden for a sec. They have like these so many cameras that can take pictures, or at least like, I don't know how it works, in these like broad sort of ring like half, you know, structures that can basically in an instant turn a play into a, like a, an explorable 3D model, like Live Kinect tech
they
or
something. They have a lot of money.
It's bonkers, but it's just funny to see like esports coverage and actual sports coverage like sort of turning into this like one
meeting in the middle.
In the middle somewhere.
The last thing I'll say on that is, is I wonder, you know, how incomprehensible is football to somebody who has never played or watched a football game in their life? Like, it's something that a lot of people take for granted, but like football has some pretty complex rules. You can at least kind of see what's happening, but even people, I know it took me several years of watching football to start understanding like why things were happening, other than it's like, oh, I know when they get a first down or something, but like to really know like why this play is being run, why that worked, that didn't, everything. Like, that's the kind of in-depth stuff that does take, that you don't get right away. That does take, you know, days or years even of experience in this medium. And so for Overwatch to be a little bit hard to parse for a newcomer, I think it's not the end of the world.
No, good casters and understanding what's happening can really kind of fill in the gaps of the cameras.
I definitely know the rules of NFL Blitz more than real football.
Just kill. Before we move on to, well, Wes, have you been playing anything? Should I ask you?
Not on the PC, really.
Right.
I played some Splatoon this weekend.
It's a good game.
Continues to be a really fun, creative shooter with about three really painful Nintendo decisions in the kind of in the online infrastructure that I just wish. I wish that game was on PC, and I wish Nintendo like made it and then gave to a Western studio to like do the lobby system and stuff. The whole lobby aesthetic where you're out with other characters is really fun, but then when you try to do like some of the matchmaking, some of the other parts of it are just like, oh, guys, you're killing me.
Please.
You're killing me with this.
Please.
Let me play on more than two maps in an hour. Like, I get your rotation idea, but I'm going to be playing for 1 hour, not four, and I would like to play more than two maps, stuff like that.
I feel you.
Still a really fun game.
It's a cool game. Nintendo's doing good stuff. Love those squid teens. Before we move on to the next topic.
It's Squid Kids.
Squid Kids. God damn it. JBJ Blaze has subscribed for 25 months in a row.
So JBJ Blaze.
Over 2 years.
Thank you.
God damn. And Burbs has subscribed for 9 months in a row. So thanks, everyone. We love seeing you guys in the Discord and in the chat as often as we can. The voices aren't in sync again. Looks like we're catching up. Next topic. Metal Gear Survive. So what do you guys know or don't know about Metal Gear Survive?
Extremely little.
Extremely little.
I know a decent bit from you. Telling me.
We chatted about it.
But it's in the Metal Gear Solid 5 engine, but it's kind of more of a survival game. There are zombies.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. So it should be a just footnote. This is a game developed after Kojima's sort of rough departure.
Was kicked out the door.
Departure.
Yeah, Konami and Kojima parted ways in the most drama we've seen in the games industry for quite some time, and gossip and so on. But we're not going to revisit that. You can go Google that shit if you want to. Regardless, Konami is still going to use the Metal Gear license to develop games, and that would make sense.
This is like the one real game they're making that's not a pachinko machine or a soccer.
Exactly. And so I'm not here to like pass judgment on. You know, I'm not trying to like back Kojima up and say you fuck Konami. I'm looking at this from just a game. This is a game, and Metal Gear Survive, still abbreviated MGS, is a survival game. It's like a straight up survival game. Imagine like Rust or Ark or any number of early access games that have come out on PC. It uses a lot of the same systems, including, well, you have a hunger meter, you have a thirst meter. And
those affect your ability to do actions and run around.
Your hunger meter acts as a cap for how much health automatically regenerates. So if you have 20%, if you're down to like 20% hunger or whatever the fuck, you can only regenerate 20% of your health automatically. And thirst is tied to stamina. So that means you can only sprint for so long if you have a, you know, your thirst meter's halfway. It's also tied, so your stamina is also tied to your crawling, which I don't know how I feel about yet.
Because that one seems like it should be a freebie. Like, let me crawl, please.
Right, because you're already moving excruciatingly slow. That's, like, already the cost and risk you're taking. But to tie stamina to that is kind of weird because, you know, they're just, like, as a cap for your movement at that point, right? Like, your stealth is limited. Point is, okay, we'll get to, like, actually the top-down structure of this game. So you... hunger, thirst, you have every object, nearly every object in the world can be broken down or collected into like resource components, iron, wood, other shit, plastic, all these you know, different components that are then used at a home base at which you can build certain facilities that kind of streamline certain stresses of the survival.
And how similar is that to the platforms in MGS5? I forget what they're called, the FOBs.
You know, it's been
a while. It's mainly mother-based, right?
Those are much more passive, yeah. I think. It's been a long time since it was 2015 when that came out. If I remember, those upgrades were a lot more passive. These are directly tied to things you're dealing with, like, every other minute. So if you get enough components, you can then build a farm or something, like a garden, and you can grow carrots there, and you can use those in recipes. To cook food, and that will keep you, you know,
and is that like, well, like you're with your character, you're like picking the, yes, pulling the carrots, yes, and then going to a cooking station or, yes, a fire pit.
All of
or
this
something.
Is like takes time, is a physical, okay, you know, requires.
So not menu driven.
It's
so
not
much.
Menu driven.
The big question I have that is because I know literally nothing about this game, yes, is, so is this a, you said it's like Rust or Ark or whatever. So is it a multiplayer game or is it a single player game?
So this is where there are some differences. It's a single player game and a multiplayer game. The single player component is what I was describing. You have this home base. There's this open world, and you go out into the open world to collect resources and to unlock these kind of warp points that, you know, streamline travel and act as like small base hubs where you can cook and do other things too. So you don't have to like walk home every single time. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'll just finish describing single player and move on to multiplayer. But the interesting part to me that also, the most interesting part and that also kind of worries me is the, about 100 yards out from the border of your base, there's a giant wall of poisonous dust that rises into the sky. And going beyond that requires donning an oxygen mask. And you get that pretty early on, like the tutorial missions. And that adds another meter that you have to babysit to you, the hunger and thirst. So you have 3 meters, oxygen, hunger, and thirst. Oxygen can only be replenished with, I think they're called Kadon crystals, or which are the crystals that the zombies are like sort of made of.
Why not like air tanks?
I don't know.
Because zombies don't carry air tanks.
So you the kill zombies are fine naturally occurring like crystal deposits in the world.
That seems like nonsense.
It's weird to me because your hunger and thirst are already they tick down fairly quickly, and they're already going to send you home or to a base or to like restock at some point, right? Unless you're super prepared and like have all the food in the world. But oxygen is like it feels like an arbitrary like just go home now meter. Again, you can refill it with Kadon crystals, but those are also used to craft certain things like weapons and upgrade your skills and yada yada.
So it's a depletable resource that you're kind of trying to save up,
yeah,
and not wanting to use for your oxygen. All
I would
the time.
Imagine you don't use it to extend your time out there to like continue exploring, but only to like get you home so you don't die. So again, it just feels like to me the oxygen meter is like go home now, a go home now meter. Who knows? Like in the long term. If it's really that much of a stress or not. But it's I think the dust is very cool and foreboding because it's hard to see. You can see landmarks sort of silhouetted in the distance, and you can see blinking lights at like stations that are points of interest you might want to hit up.
So you're going to be spending most of the game in this dust storm?
I think so.
Seems like it might get a little monotonous.
Yeah. That's my problem. Is like it's very foreboding. It's cool because your map turns off and you have to navigate using flags you plant or like landmarks or whatever. And then if you successfully return, that map data will be uploaded, and then you can see, you know, where you've been. But yeah, unless there's a way to permanently get like rid of the certain chunks of the dust storm, I have a hard time thinking the world will be interesting to explore.
I feel like it has. Just from a game design standpoint, I feel like it has to. Like if I was making that game, I would say, okay, once you've gotten to this place, like you clear the dust and you can explore there freely or something.
Yeah, it would be
satisfying. Then it gets into the like the climb the towers, Far Cry problem. So
wiping the map clean.
Yeah.
So you played what, 4 or 5 hours of this game?
4 hours of the single player and then an hour multiplayer. And the single player, it seems like a cool like. Focused survival game in the way that a lot of early access games are not. It's complete, so it's done, and you can build certain things, and there's like supposedly like it takes like 20 to 25 hours to finish, so there's an end. And whether or not the world is interesting, a lot is banking on like whether the world is interesting despite it being covered in dust all the time, or if you can remove that, because I should also note, it has a stamp system a la Breath of the Wild, which I like a lot. I think a lot more open world games should let you kind of make notes on your map. I love that. But yeah, it might be boring. It might be boring to explore in the dust forever. And there's a huge focus on melee combat.
Which was, I think, your biggest issue with this game.
Your stealth is an option sometimes, like when you're trying to sneak into a base to obtain like some data or plan to build a new thing, weapon.
Are these bases manned by zombies?
They're not. Yeah, I mean, they're just kind of spread around.
So they're just kind of like empty, like everything is apocalyptic, empty, but there are zombies around.
There are zombies wandering. And my problem with the zombies is that if one sees you, they quickly alert every single zombie in the area. So you have hordes on your tail from one mistake in like seconds. And whereas in MGS5, and this may prove to be this similar as I progress further in Metal Gear Survive, in MGS5, I feel like the soldier AI you could really fuck with a lot more and toy with, and you could correct a mistake if you were spotted or something fairly quickly. That's really, at least from the early hours, not the case here. If a zombie spots you, the horde's on your tail, and you have to run. That's not a bunch of fun. On one hand, you can also like place fences now, or like sandbags, or like anywhere in the world, defensive structures.
Zombies can't climb over fences.
They can. They bash at it for a while, but then as it degrades, they can eventually climb over it. What's cool is that I guess you can place a fence down, and then some weapons you can poke them in the head through the fence, which is kind of cool. But I don't, that engine and that like game, all the game systems within that engine, like. I don't think of the melee combat really, you know, as a driving force for what I enjoy.
I mean, it was very much for takedowns on a guard that you usually would catch unawares. Not always, but like you would come up behind a guy and choke him out, or like do the three punch combo, knock him out. And that was about it.
And here there are. Later in the skill tree, because again you can like earn these crystals to upgrade your skills and level up and so on, you can unlock combos and things. And in the trailer you can see on PCGamer.com there's like big weapons and all sorts of melee highlighted in that trailer, and it doesn't feel great, at least in time I played, because to use a melee weapon you have to like aim with it. So you have to hold down like the aim button, and then
for like a knife or something,
almost like Resident Evil 4. Yeah, like
that's not the best.
Yeah, and your movement's pretty limited, and the enemies there's so many of them sometimes, and they're so quick and erratic that it's very easy to get overwhelmed. So I don't know. Maybe there's something in the progression that builds around that system that makes it more fun. And
it kind of sounds to me like you just need to be more stealthy and just don't let them see you at all. It's the ultimate stealth game.
And maybe that's right. And maybe you get more gadgets that help you do that and are specifically built and tuned for playing with the hordes.
Yeah.
It's just like early on, I was more frustrated than I was excited by the potential. And I think some of the more interesting stuff will be the multiplayer, which is directly tied to the single player. So,
how does that work?
Multiplayer, you get into a lobby with like four friends, and you go to these missions built around like defense, defending
kind of horde mode fort. Type thing.
It's basically a horde mode. But you bring in the resources you've gathered from single player, and you can gather some more while you're out in the multiplayer world to build fences and to build defenses. And I guess later on you can build like the bipedal mechs, and there's some really high end stuff you can get into. And you basically, you head to a point, zombies kind of march in your direction, and there are a whole bunch of different types I've yet to see as well. You just defend a point, put up fences, bash them in the head, shoot them with whatever you got. And
sounds kind of like pre-Battle Royale Fortnite.
Yeah, it's weirdly Fortnite-ish without, I think, as complex or of a building system. Hmm. And it's not, I don't know, what I played, we were under-leveled for, so there is a leveling system, and zombies also have levels.
Level, of course they do. Level 15 zombie coming at you.
Which I also don't know how I feel about. I guess, I need to see the full scope of how that works. But
zombies been working out, I guess.
There are apparently some recipes you can only earn in multiplayer that to take back into
like
the
food recipes or like
I'm not like exactly sure, but like items. Weapons, I imagine it's all sorts. Like I imagine it's buildings and weapons and everything. So they tie directly into one another. What's kind of annoying is that like the resources you use in multiplayer are gone when you get back to single player. Oh, so
that's annoying.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds like it could be fun, but it also sort of sounds like it's the opposite of what you would really hope for a co-op Metal Gear game to be.
Yeah.
You're building bases to defend against enemies when I think like what would be an incredibly fun co-op Metal Gear game, it would be sneaking into bases
exactly.
with like a four-man team and approaching it from different directions. One person like goes in the sewer way, somebody else like hijacks a truck and drives it in with somebody hiding
GTA heist.
Yeah, like a GTA heist, exactly. But with Metal Gear's stealth mechanics. That sounds amazing. And I'm sure there are tons of challenges there with, you know, with the AI you would have to work out. But I feel like even in Metal Gear Solid 5, the bases are complex enough and have enough routes in and ways that you can approach them that would work with multiple people.
I think so, too. And so it's weird to see this. It feels like I don't think it's necessarily going to be awful. What's there feels functional in that engine. It feels good to move as that character and play as that character. It's just a matter of really seeing how, you know, the melee combat plays out and how interesting that world is, and if you know, surviving in that world is actually fun, and playing with those systems over the period of 20 hours is fun. We'll see. I don't know, like, because I know there are a lot of gadgets I've yet to unlock and a lot of things to that I just have not seen that the early hours can't even begin to reveal. First impressions, I'm cautious, still optimistic, but I'm severely, it's kind of like meh right now.
I think, too, it's a good thing overall that they are not trying to ape Kojima's weirdness and style. But at the same time, if it doesn't have someone's take on what Metal Gear is as a setting, then I think it's going to be kind of disappointing. You know, like, it's got to have some character to it. If it's just totally flat, then you're just using the Metal Gear brand because they own it, right?
I will say, like, it feels pretty flat. It feels like, on one hand, I'm happy they didn't try to just do a Kojima impression. On the other hand, it's super, like, how you're introduced in the world is super brief. You're just dumped through a wormhole, and you're kind of...
A wormhole?
Yeah, you get dumped, apparently, like, in Metal Gear Solid 5, opens up. And you get sucked through a wormhole, then dumped into another world, and you have to find your way back. It's like they're like, so they don't have to do anything that's directly tied to Metal Gear or Kojima's Metal Gear. They're like, yeah, it's a new universe. you're literally just get sucked through a wormhole, and we don't have to worry about that stuff.
All right.
Yeah, sure. Like, I don't want Big Boss. I don't want Meryl. I don't want any of that stuff. But I would like something that feels vaguely Metal Gear-ish to justify the connection.
I mean, there might, that again,
wormhole's not a bad place to start, honestly.
It's not a bad place to start, and that stuff might be in there eventually, like boss battles maybe, or characters you encounter along the way. I don't really know how much story's in there, but I'm super curious. I know it's comes out pretty soon, like next month. So
it's February, right? February?
February 20th or something like that. And I know there's an open beta happening, or maybe it's for pre-orders only, like within the next couple days. So I think we'll know more about the scope of that game pretty soon, and I'm curious to see what it looks like. So,
alrighty, that's Metal Gear Survive.
That is Metal Gear Survive. and other things that we're trying to survive like a shitstorm for GPU prices. Yeah.
Things are real bad.
Things are pretty bad right now. It's not good. It's not good. Bo, can you kind of walk us through what the hell's going on here?
I can. So there's this thing called cryptocurrency mining.
Yes.
I don't know if you've heard of it. Bitcoin.
Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is a thing. Blockchain. Other buzzwords.
Gotta get in that blockchain biz.
Yeah.
Get in there.
Yeah. This has been going on for, you know, more than a year or so, but the things have gotten worse and better in kind of varying degrees over the last year or two. Long story short, the graphics cards that we use to play our games, for those of you who are not familiar, the graphics cards that we use to play our games can also be used to mine cryptocurrency. And over the last couple weeks especially, or at least month or two, those cryptocurrencies have exploded in value even more so than they have before. You know, Bitcoin years and years ago was worth less than, you know, pennies per coin, and then it spiked to 200 and then to 1,000, and people thought that that was insane. And then it went up to, like, I think peaked at 22,000 or something sometime.
I thought it was like 15 or 16.
I think it was at least 18, if not 20. It was the absolute peak.
Okay.
Maybe even 22. They're like, I'm like peak. But it was kind of averaging, levered out to, you know, in the $16,000 to $18,000 per Bitcoin range. Very expensive stuff. And that meant that mining cryptocurrency using your run-of-the-mill graphics card was actually a pretty efficient thing to do. You could make a good bit of money. A lot of people had that idea, and so they've been buying up graphics cards even at higher, much higher than listed prices.
Guessing a lot of people more jumping on the bandwagon effect than the, like, really doing the math and figuring out how much money they would make.
That's the thing. I mean, the ballooning in the prices of these currencies has definitely helped, because the thing is, for a while, the math problem that potential miners had to do is you had to balance, like, every GPU has a, I think the, even I'm not great on the terms, but basically their hash rate is how efficiently it can mine. And you balanced the initial cost of purchasing that card with the hash rate, how efficient it was at mining, with its power consumption, the cost of running that, running it basically.
Running it 24 hours.
Yeah, all the time. And so, you know, hypothetically, if a card mines you $10 worth of Bitcoin every day and it costs you $5 per day in power, and it, you know, costs $100 to buy, like, you use those numbers to look at your break-even point and whether or not it would be worth it for you to do this. And so for a while, the first cards that got hit were the AMD's RX 570, 580, those cards, they were pretty power. They were basically the difference between their hash rate and their power consumption was the greatest. The people were getting the best return.
They were good mining cards.
They were good mining cards, yeah. And so they were the first to become overpriced. People were willing to pay 50 or 100 bucks over MSRP for these cards. And then as those cards strictly went out of stock, the rest of
GPU lines started getting hit. They were slightly, maybe, you know, a GTX 1080 might may mine you 11 per day, but the power difference was it cost 8 or something. I don't know. Again, hypothetical numbers. But yeah, so long story short, this has been going on for a while, but because of the ballooning prices in the last month or two, as well as, like you said, a lot of people kind of bandwagoning and getting into it, GPU prices are insane right now. Like, not just 50 or 100 bucks over MSRP, like double the price. Like,
God
like
damn.
Several hundred dollars more than it should be.
And we're talking mostly cards that are a year to a year and a half old.
Yeah, like coming up, the GTX 10 series cards launched, what, mid-2016?
It was the first wave was summer 2016.
Yeah, yeah, so we're coming up on 2 years old for these cards. Cards that, like, had their initial release cost where they were, then you could find them for a little bit more, like a little bit higher price than that because they were really high in demand. Then as the demand trailed off and the early adopters got all their cards that they wanted, they fell down to, so take the GTX 1070 as the best example. Launch MSRP was like 400 to 450 depending on the card. You could find them for 500 plus for a while. I think I bought mine a few months after launch at 450 when it like first came into stock. Mm. And then there was a point in time when you could find them on sale for as cheap as like 350, maybe even 320 or something, or if you found like a really good deal. But for the most part, they were always available in the like 400-ish dollar range. Yeah,
MSRP or a bit below, as you would expect.
Right around there, you know, if you find a deal or a sale or something like that. And then that was the thing, is when the first wave of cryptocurrency hit, like, they kind of ballooned back up to that, like, oh, it's back up to 450 or 500, and then they were available back at MSRP. Like, them being overpriced was that they were back at MSRP as opposed to being cheaper than MSRP.
And we're like, wow, this card's a year old, and it costs as much as it did when it launched.
Yeah,
that's weird.
It was pretty weird. Now the 1070 is, like, I don't know, $700-$900. If you can even find one in stock,
that's like, that's too much.
Yeah, and
don't buy that.
I'm not just talking about like the resale value on eBay or something, which like even that you can resell a used 1070 on eBay for like 600 some right now. But I'm talking about like the new prices are upwards of $700-$900. Like, it's crazy. It sucks really for gamers because we were not trying to mine cryptocurrency. I mean, maybe you are, but like, you know, how good something is, that the price of Bitcoin doesn't make a 1070 any better at, you know, at rendering Tub Geralt.
Important activities like rendering Tub Geralt.
Exactly. Yeah, and it sucks. And so really, you know, the best advice we have right now is, unfortunately, like, don't buy a graphics card. It's a really terrible time to buy a GPU right now.
Not a bad time to sell your graphics card.
Yeah, if you have an extra one lying around. Yeah.
If you have an extra one, or if you're like, you know what, I'm just not playing games too much right now. I'm kind of waiting for that next GPU series to come out. Like, you know, NVIDIA will probably announce new cards, you know, in the next 6 months or a year or something. 2 years from the 10 series launch feels you know, kind of a reasonable time. If you're kind of just like waiting for that new stuff to come out, might not be a bad time to sell your card.
Yeah. And weirdly, you might even be able to make some money by like the one area that has not been hit too hard with these prices is with pre-built systems. You know, normally we highly recommend building your own PC because the price of the individual components is usually at least a few hundred dollars less than the price of buying a fully pre-configured system. But those pre-configured systems, they actually haven't gone up too much in price because the cards are still getting sold to the system integrators for about the same price. They're reselling maybe a little bit more, but like not too much more. So at this point, sometimes you can buy like a GTX 1070 configured system for not too much more than like just the price of the 1070 alone.
Damn.
So yeah, there is weirdly a market for like buying a pre-built, even just taking the card out of it, reselling it immediately, and then like, you know,
playing on your graphics or doing something. I think the big question, which we probably don't have an answer to, is just when is this going to change? And I don't think we know. I mean, all the crypto markets dropped like 20-25% yesterday due to some news, but I think they've kind of all bounced back to
it's all
about
kind
where
of
they were.
Around.
It's very volatile, but I don't think anytime soon there's going to be a specific thing that causes a lull in people buying cards.
I mean, that's the thing is the cryptocurrency market is so volatile, like on a daily basis, fluctuating thousands of dollars, whereas we're comparing that to this supply and demand of a physical thing that has to be produced, that it's a significantly slower thing. So basically you have this slow thing responding to this very fast thing. And so even if the market fell out today, like, it would still take a little while for cards to, return to normal prices, because if there are none, there are none.
I think, unfortunately, this is a problem we're going to continue to see until, and I don't know if this is going to actually happen, but I'm hoping it does, until, like, NVIDIA and AMD ramp up some production of cards built expressly for mining.
Yeah.
I mean, they have to, at this point, see the value in that for them. If they can make these cards for crypto mining, people are going to buy them. If they do that and keep the gaming cards kind of separate, then hopefully that will make the gaming cards much more reliably in stock and less of a target for people looking to mine.
I think that will happen. Jared sort of explained this pretty well a while back, is that was kind of what happened originally with Bitcoin, is like when Bitcoin first was like coming onto the scene, people were using graphics cards to mine it. And then people, whether they were hardware companies or I forget what the acronym is, but it's like, basically, they developed specific mining units that were not like just taking a consumer grade graphics card and repurposing it. It's like specifically built for mining in a way that maximizes the hash rate and minimizes the power consumption and all this stuff. And so Bitcoin has basically been optimized for that. So like when we say GPUs are being used to mine, they're not actually mining Bitcoin for the most part. The thing is they're mining these new cryptocurrencies like Ethereum, Litecoin, Ripple, I think. Like,
yep.
There's all these other cryptocurrencies which people will mine them and then exchange those for Bitcoin, or they have their own individual prices. And it was the Ethereum boom that caused this first wave of overpriced for us in the last year or so. On the one hand, at some point, basically, this new wave of cryptocurrencies, either the bubble's going to burst and the market's going to fall out, or they will continue to grow, but the hardware of it will be modified and made efficient to a point that it is no longer cost-effective for the big miners, because that's the thing there being no cards available on the market, it's not from like your average person going to the store and being like, I want to get into crypto mining and buying them one at a time. This is like big major players in the market who are buying them up by the hundred or thousand,
building rigs with a dozen cards,
building warehouses full of these to maximize their profit. I mean, we ran a story at one point a couple weeks or months ago about like a crypto company like literally renting a private jet to transport the cards, because as they were coming off shelves, the transit time via boat was like, it was more cost efficient for them to rent a private plane to ship them, carry all these cards, than to wait the like 3 weeks or whatever for the cards to come via boat. They were losing money. That was time that could have been spent mining in their mind. So
goddamn.
So this is going to keep being a story for the foreseeable future.
And like I said, hopefully it will self correct at some point, and it may spike or bottom out again. I'm sure it will. There will be these things will happen, but hopefully it'll hit a nice level.
I hope so, because I want a new goddamn graphics card right now.
You're not alone there.
No, a lot of frustrated folks out there. Bo, You weren't here last week.
I was not. I was gone.
Where were you last week?
I was at CES. I get to talk about more hardware. Hooray.
More hardware. And we last week we talked about kind of the two big things that stood out to us, at least, which were the NVIDIA's BFGD
display. BFGD. It stands for big... No, it's a big format gaming display.
Those are cool.
They're pretty cool. Yeah, I was going to talk about that, but it sounds like you guys talked about it last week.
Yes.
Quick recap, they're like 65-inch monitors with G-Sync and 120 hertz, which is
that's awesome.
Really rad.
They're going to be very expensive.
Like, they're going to be super expensive. The one thing that I can add that you probably didn't hit on is with this, you know, CES is a time to where companies unveil their like moonshot products that are crazy far off in the distance. We had... Even of a thing that is definitely coming, but we are still waiting on at CES last year, Acer and Asus and the other monitor companies, they unveiled the 4K 144 hertz HDR monitors. Basically like the 4K equivalent of the gaming monitors that we recommend most, which is 27-inch 144 hertz at 1440p. Basically the 4K HDR versions of that. And we were like, this is great. These are the next generation of our favorite monitor. Like, we want these very much.
Yeah.
And at the time, CES last year, they said these are coming, you know, Q2 of this year. And a year later, they still have, like,
nothing.
They were showing them off again this year. I was like, hey, there's that thing. When's it coming? They're like, we don't know. So there's products like that. But the sense that I got... is that NVIDIA has been working on this BFGD thing for a while, and that even though it seems like kind of a moonshot product that seems like it'll be pretty far off, it may actually be coming sooner than we think. I say this with like 1,000 grains of salt because this is a time scale that I have no actual bearing into. Wes, you want to go dance to turn the lights back on? There we go. So like, it is still a ways off, but hopefully sooner than we think. That'd be cool. You know, maybe sometime this year.
They're going to be expensive.
But yeah, they're going to be super expensive. Thousands of dollars,
well,
probably.
Something to look forward to. Besides that, and we got to get the questions soon, but can you kind of get, I kind of want to know what like it's like being at the show.
Yeah. It was my first CES.
Yeah.
It was, CES is a weird show. It's got, you know, it's one of those things, that, especially for us, it's weird because the things that we're interested at CES is like such a tiny sliver of this huge conference. So, you know, there were people there doing the big topics that of CES in general were AI, automation, you know, self-driving cars, things like that.
Internet of Things.
And then Internet of Things. The smart home was extremely prevalent. This was the CES where like tech has gone mainstream. Like,
okay.
You know, everybody, not just everybody has a smartphone, but like everybody has a house and appliances and is interested in buying potentially a smart vacuum or a smart refrigerator. You know, not everybody is, but like these are, everybody uses vacuums and refrigerators.
They are hoping that
everyone is interested, will want these, you know, smart versions of these things.
It's cool.
So yeah, that's what the rest of CES was. For us specifically, PC Gamer, I saw a fair number of laptops. That's one of my hardware specialties. And which is to say, I didn't actually see that many new laptops. The kind of answer I got from all the companies when I was asking them what's coming is they're like, well, we're making new laptops this year, but Intel has like the next generation of Intel graphics, or not graphics, processors for laptops is still not officially announced, so we can't talk about these.
Well, damn.
But yeah, so there will be new laptops this year. That'll be cool. They'll be more powerful than what we're using now.
Good.
Hooray. Again, another case where if you need a high-end graphic situation, you know,
maybe get a laptop.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to the Max-Q designs, which are the very thin, high performance
systems stuff,
getting a little more normalized. And like, I'm sure within a generation or two, they'll stop having like the trackpad in a really weird place because the heat sink was too hot for it to be somewhere else.
I was really hoping that there would be a handful of like next generation Max-Q laptops being unveiled. There weren't, but like, asked whoever I could about them, and they were like, yeah, the reception to them has been really well. It's obviously what everybody, like, the ideal situation is to have a high performance gaming laptop
that is also thin,
that is also, you know, an ultrabook.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, I didn't actually see any of them at the show. I didn't get a chance to, but a handful of ultrabooks with integrated graphics are kind of starting to trickle out. This is from
you mean with dedicated graphics?
With dedicated, not integrated. With dedicated graphics. Granted, they are extremely low end dedicated graphics, but this is what has come out of that Intel AMD partnership build laptop graphic solutions. From what I can tell, it's the Kaby Lake G processor, which has basically a low-end AMD card in it, but it's still like an ultrabook, basically. So that's something I'm going to be investigating in the coming weeks and months, is testing these kind of low-end but ultrabook systems, at basically testing them with a test suite that is obviously less demanding than our high-end
for 4K systems. Yeah.
You know, I'm not testing them at 1440 or 4K and ultra settings and Ghost Recon Wildlands or something that's super intense, but for these games that, you know, like League of Legends or Overwatch or, you know, indie games, different things that aren't nearly as demanding but still like take a little bit of juice.
The standard integrated graphics that Intel has been using for a few years.
So yeah, that's something to look out for. The final thing is, I got a sense that more and more companies are taking note of what, at least the things that I really liked in this latest generation of laptops, which was laptops starting to get things like higher refresh rate screens, having G-Sync, you know, having a nice keyboard, being thinner and lighter whenever possible. And so I think more and more, hopefully more and more, the higher refresh rate screens is really a big selling point, I think, that we will see on more laptops in the future.
The keyboard is still such a crapshoot.
Yeah, it really is.
Laptops.
But yeah.
What else happened is, yes, I know that...
there was one moment.
Yeah,
I know.
A moment.
There was a moment. One day, I think it was Wednesday of the show, which was actually the only day I actually went to the expo floor. I was in meetings like the other day, all the other days. Twan and I are walking through the CS floor, and all of a sudden, total darkness.
God, can you imagine?
All the lights shut off. And like for a quarter second, I thought that there was about to be like the music was going to swell and like lights were going to come up and then like the biggest, Steve Jobs was going to appear and
the
be
biggest
like,
TV ever.
Yeah, like something insane was going to happen. You know, just come out of the ground with smoke and everything. No, it was actually just a straight up power failure. The Las Vegas Convention Center lost power for about 2 hours.
That's rough.
I would love to know the numbers of like how much money was lost by the second there, but I took some pretty cool pictures of like these massive booths of TVs just off.
That's got to be so eerie. Like, I don't know if any of you have ever been like on a big convention show floor, that it's lights and sound.
Oh, it's every
people, and for that to just go black.
I mean, like, luckily there was enough kind of ambient light from either coming in from outside, or there were a few booths that had like battery powered stuff. There was enough light in there. I mean, funny, the first thing that happened is literally everybody just got out their phones and turned on their flashlights to like get around. You know, there was like shock and then laughter, and then we just kind of went about our business, just shuffled around. There was no panic. There was no screaming or anything. Everybody just kind of shuffled around. Various journalists, like myself included, whipped out their laptops, pulled up a mobile hotspot to, like, write about this one. Because I was talking to Twan. It's funny. Like I said earlier, you know, the parts of CES that are relevant to PC Gamer and our audience is, like, such a tiny sliver of CES as a whole. And similarly, like, everybody else there, like, there's no single outlet that covers, like, every single thing at CES. But this was like the one thing that was relevant to every single journalist
except
who was there.
This year, yeah.
So like everybody wrote the same thing as like, well, Las Vegas Convention Center just lost power. This is crazy.
That's pretty wild. Did you have a good time though overall?
I did, yeah, it was fun.
Almost made me sad to miss it.
Yeah.
The power outage.
It was my first CES. I will probably go back. You know, it was good.
Bring us that good hardware news.
You know.
Well, thanks for bringing it last week. It was a lot of good stuff you guys did. And now we're going to move on and open it up to Twitch chat Q&A. We have quite a few questions this week already gathered from the PC Gamer Club Discord. If you don't know what the hell I'm talking about, that's you can find out more at club.pcgamer.com. We have a monthly subscription service now, and you get an ad-free experience on the site. You get a free game each month. You get the whatever beta keys we receive first.
And now you get some cool in-game items.
Yeah, you get cool in-game items that I mentioned at the top of the show, and we hope to bring you more beyond Rising Storm 2 and Elite Dangerous. So. Yes, to pay attention for those. Again, you also get access to our PC Gamer Club Discord, which is where we pull questions from first and read from first. You can also ask them in the chat, though. Just tag at PC Gamer if you have something. And if we have time, we'll get to it. We do have a bunch this week, so no promises. But we will try our best. Let's open up with this one from Janrin. And this is mostly a prompt for me, and Janrin asks, last week, one day after the PC Gamer show, there was a Nintendo Direct Mini with some cool announcements. Any special thoughts about them? And I'm pretty sure he's just elbowing me in the ribs here, because I didn't talk about this last week. Guess what we got? Dark Souls Remastered is coming on May 25th to the PC, and that we don't really know too much about like what the remaster encompasses.
How does it make you feel?
There's been a lot of misinformation and confusion.
Yeah, about like prices and like what engine it runs in and so on. We do know 4K textures and just better PC support overall, 60 FPS support from the get-go, and beyond that, like there will be bug fixes and so on. But
you're gonna do a replay?
Yeah, I'm kind of a sucker for that series. Dream about it all the time.
Literally dream?
Yeah. I think about it a lot. I constantly read lore theories and browse the art. I will get it for my Switch and obviously for the PC because I'll be covering it for our site, I'm sure.
I'm not convinced it's going to run very well on the Switch.
I'm pretty sure it won't.
I think they'll probably get it to like a stable 720, 30 FPS. It probably isn't going to drop crazy frames in Blighttown like it used to. But still, once there's a 60 FPS version of that game playable, why play it at 30?
Yeah. Pretty much. I think for me, it'll be the novelty of just like on the bus. I can just whip out, you know, my Switch and like dink around with a specific build or something. Because that's when I daydream about Dark Souls. I wish I could just play Dark Souls.
Just do it anywhere.
So even if it's a subpar experience, the novelty.
You've always wanted to play it on the beach.
Exactly. Nice margarita in one hand and Dark Souls in the other. yeah, exciting. May 25th. We'll have more as that approaches, I'm sure. Next question, Maniac86. People often make the observation that World War II games do Operation Overlord, D-Day, landings too much. Call of Duty and Medal of Honor have done them at least twice each alone. And he asks, what is your favorite D-Day level, and which is the worst? I don't know if you guys have a catalog like in your mind that you can easily access. Conquer's Bad Fur Day. That's a good answer.
I can't remember if that's in the original or if it's only in the Xbox version.
I couldn't tell you either. But I can't like easily access those memories. I can say that when the Call of Duty 2 or Call of Duty 2's, I think, was coincided with like an update in the engine. And I thought
that's the only one I've played, actually.
I played the Medal of Honor ones way back when, but a lot of those bleed together for me. Call of Duty 2 stands out just as being like this update in graphics and characters on screen and all these things at once that it felt.
Yeah, it was an Xbox 360 launch game and was also on PC.
Yeah,
that's the only one I've played, I think. I haven't played Medal of Honor, really. But that's kind of the the canonical best is the Medal of Honor. Spielberg,
yes,
you know, Saving Private Ryan influence there.
Yeah, definitely. I think the worst for me is also the latest, which was World War II's Call of Duty World War II's Normandy level was just, it felt it was brief, almost like a bullet point, and all, like maybe the graphics are too real now, that like or too nice, that the fidelity is more uncanny than it is, and I don't know, it didn't hit, or it just been done so many times before too, I don't know. Call of Duty 2 for me. If you have one in chat, drop it, let me know, remind us. Next question. Butts asks, what's a video game soundtrack that you could listen to and never get tired of?
Stardew Valley.
Yeah, that's a good one. You can just have that on the background. And
it's just, I listen to that one all the time.
Yeah.
Never get tired of. I don't know.
Never get tired of?
I mean, I love the Bastion soundtrack.
Mm.
I've gotten tired of it, though, so I know that I can't answer that. Like, but I love that soundtrack.
That's fair. The original Nier, which is not on PC, but is a fantastic soundtrack. I feel like I'd probably go insane if I listened to like a Mario soundtrack over and over again, but those melodies are timeless.
Yeah, I really love the, I've talked about this at great length, especially with Evan, the Crypt of the NecroDancer soundtrack is outstanding, and especially because there are a great number of excellent remixes of it and reinterpretations, ranging from chiptunes to synthwave to metal to all these different versions. And so
that's a great one.
It's a really great, like, almost like canvas soundtrack that has been reinterpreted in so many different ways that I don't know if that's a way of like cheating to get around it, but I've listened to it enough times and never gotten tired of it.
Halo, maybe.
Halo is always good. For me, I think VVV is infinitely listenable, the soundtrack for that game. It's just catchy and sometimes quiet, and in the same way that Crypt of the NecroDancer soundtrack has been covered in so many different ways, the same goes for these. Or VVV. There's a lot of good ones coming out lately. Cuphead is, I think, is just good music, period. You know, it doesn't need to be in a game to listen to. Oikospiel for me. There's this list on PCGamer.com, the best music of the year for 2017, with a bunch of soundtracks that I'm sure you could find infinitely listenable. But thanks for the question, Butts. PCG Evan, who's this, I wonder, asks, and this is I kept this question because it's a troll question. What's the worst thing about The Witcher 3?
Play combat.
You don't like the combat?
I'm not saying I don't like the combat.
Okay.
But
that's the worst thing about it.
It can be the worst thing. Right. And also, I mean, I'm sure there's little moments, right? Like, oh, you bugged out and had to reload. The Witcher sense. The worst thing about it is in the Witcher sense system, you like hold a button down to sort of highlight objects, stuff like that. They mess with the FOV,
the fisheye.
It does like a fisheye thing, and it makes me nauseous a little bit.
They did in one of the latest updates, just let you turn that fisheye effect off.
Oh, that's nice. I should do that.
It's no longer the worst thing about the
Witcher. Yeah, I used to have to like kind of squint.
I hated that effect
at the monitor when I used that mode for
appreciate
too long.
Appreciate what they're going for, but for me, it's just any minor like open world activity in that game.
Monster nests, stuff like that.
And again, those things aren't like, it's hard to call them the worst because you don't really have to do them. You can just ignore them. But sometimes I just. Even feeling compelled to do them at all annoys me a little bit. I'm like, eh.
Yeah, my first like 20 hours of the game, I wasn't being like completionist, but I would definitely be like, oh, I'm in this area, I should like do these points on the map and go. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, I was just like, no, I'm not gonna go kill these monster nests. There's no reason to. Yeah. But having them on the mini map, if you don't turn them off, kind of fits into that obsessive open world mindset of like, there's 700 activities and I need to do all of them.
I think Canon 2711 has the best answer, and it's choosing between Triss and Yennefer. It's probably the worst thing.
Heartbreaker.
Thanks for the question, Evan. It's a good one. Comrade Cupcake, who is Lauren Morton, who writes a lot for PC Gamer, asks, what non-fishing game has the best fishing minigame? Bonus points if you phone a friend to ask your dad.
I would say not mechanically, but vibe-wise, Animal Crossing.
Yeah.
Which is not a PC game.
It's super
simple. Not a PC game, but I was going to say Ocarina of Time.
Okay.
Like, in that you actually have to, like, place your lure, position it. You could scare fish away.
I think Stardew Valley has a decent one.
I've gotten good at it, but I feel like it's a lot of people hate that fishing mechanic.
I think it's fine. It can be frustrating, but I think the act of fishing in that game, similarly to Animal Crossing, is just like like most things in that game, fairly relaxing.
I do think it's relaxing, but in terms,
it's the weird bar balancing thing is maybe not as easy to parse or get a hang of, but it's fine.
Okay, here's a deep cut for you: the Amazon Trail.
God damn, Wes, that is a deep cut.
You do like spear fishing out of your boat on the Amazon.
You know, I got a friend who he goes fishing with a bow and arrow. Yeah.
Excuse me.
You have to like study how the water refracts the fish. Dang. And he's extremely good at it.
How far into the water can an arrow penetrate before it loses?
Pretty far.
Because, I mean, bullets only go like a few feet before they start losing velocity, right?
Spear guns go work underwater.
There are special like arrows too that you can get for this, tied to a rope and everything too.
That's cool.
I think that's why they bow fish as opposed to like shoot them with guns.
Well, also they had bows before guns.
True.
I think Far Cry 5, I've only dinked around with the fishing system a few times in a demo, but it looks fairly like simple to do, but maybe difficult to master. Like, you have to worry about like fly fishing. You have to worry about where you lead the line and how much you reel versus try to tire out the fish, and you can also see the fish in the water, so it could be really cool. I hope so. We'll see. There's your answer, Lauren. Thanks for the question. Moving on. Helkgeier asks, are Bungie ever going to patch D2 and not piss half their players off?
No, it's never going to happen.
Probably not at this
point. I've never played this game.
And I haven't even read up on the latest thing, but I guess our news guy Andy is really into Destiny 2, and he's like, in our chat this morning, like, God damn it, they did it again. So he wrote up something on, I guess, which is a weird cap of how many coins you can earn in this latest faction event. I don't know. I haven't played in weeks, so I'm waiting for a lot of those big changes in the development posts they put out a couple weeks ago to come through.
My takeaway from his, not write-up, but just his commentary in our chat room was that the most efficient way to play this D2 update would involve you eating like 40 sandwiches a day or something. I don't know.
What?
Well, you have to eat a sandwich between every cooldown for the coin cap. I don't know.
Yeah.
Am I eating the sandwich or is my character?
You are. Because basically you have to wait a period of time between doing a thing that you do. Like, in order to get, you only get value like every 10 minutes for doing a thing that only takes, what, like a few minutes to do, like 2 or 3 minutes. Yeah. And so he's like, you do one, go make yourself a sandwich, and then you do the next one.
Come back.
This is going to ruin sandwiches for me. I can't do 40 a day.
I love sandwiches. I'm going to get a sandwich after this.
I ate a sandwich before this.
Damn.
But only one, not 40, right?
Just the one.
Just the one.
My sandwich and your sandwich and the show makes a sandwich of its own.
Oh, my God, a thought sandwich, a conceptual sandwich. You know what I want to do? This is totally I want to all this talk of sandwiches has made me want to, like, go get a burger and beer and watch Overwatch League, like, friends. Can we do that?
There's some match happening.
And then you start a team called Conceptual Sandwich.
I just want to watch the game with my boys.
You can do that.
Okay.
Do you want to go watch the match after work today, Jason? Yeah, we can do that.
It's going to be our future. thanks for the question, or joke question. Favis, I always forget how to pronounce his name. Serious question, though, because he previously asked in the chat who we would human centipede with. Not going to answer that. What book do you think should be turned into a game, and what sort of game? We've written a post about this in the past, but so many games have come out since then, and we might think of the answer differently. But is anything spring to mind for you? Book should be turned into a game. I will say, I think Stephen King's On Writing should be a video game. I've been reading the Southern Reach trilogy. Do you guys know this?
I read the first one. I wasn't blown away.
Yeah,
it came highly recommended, and I was like, that's okay.
I think it's a good Lovecraft impression. But I really liked it. It's kind of my – I really like that slow, detached sort of
– It's very detached.
Yeah, yeah. It so often indirectly describes what the characters are seeing as, and it's, oh, it's indescribable. I think it's a cool – it would be cool to see Area X, this, like, weird quarantined – futuristic. I don't know, like there's some weird biological things happening in this area. I don't want to spoil it for everyone. There's a movie coming out too by the 28 Days Later Ex Machina director. It could be a cool like sandbox, open world sandbox, a threatening open world sandbox. I can't think of anything beyond that, but that's fresh in my mind, that book, Annihilation.
I'm gonna go with an extremely specific cut that probably not many people have read, but one of my favorite books is called Glass House. It's a sci-fi book where the rough premise is that it's, you know, far future.
Yeah.
They have, like, teleportation in the form of matter compilers and stuff. But having said that, the protagonists are in a almost colonial-type situation.
Hmm.
But weirdly, like, it's also a, like, a social engineering game, like, with game mechanics in the situation where they have to, like, they know they're from the future, basically, but they have to maintain, like, current era. I forget what the era is. I think it's maybe, like, 70s or 80s or something, or maybe, like, 60s, 1960s or something. Well, I'll say hypothetically that it's, like, 1960s. They have to, like, wear era-appropriate clothing and speak in era-appropriate phrasing and everything and maintain their like lives that they have been placed into, and if they go out of that, they are if they do it, they are awarded points, and if they mess up, they are docked points, and it's all on like this social tattletale, like reporting on each other type thing that I feel like it just totally pulled this out of nowhere, but it would make for an interesting, maybe like even like a visual novel situation or some type of adventure game. It's actually almost reminding me of Lady Killer in a Bind, where you have to like maintain appearances and there's like an era or a level of social like deception and engineering and things like that. I don't know.
That could be cool.
Interesting.
It was a very weird.
I mean, like
that. Maybe one person out
there
has read.
We're not pro game designers. We just have.
Yeah.
You know,
that was my random
concept.
Thought.
Hey,
there came into my head.
James, have you read Blood Meridian?
I have. What? No. You can't do that. That'd be a fucked up game, man.
I'm just kidding. Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy would make for a terrible video game.
Dark Souls 4, Blood Meridian.
I'll keep with the sci-fi theme.
Yeah.
There's a book called Altered Carbon that's actually getting a Netflix adaptation in a few weeks, I think.
Pretty
I want to say February is when it's coming
out. Yeah.
So the trailer, it looked all right.
Hard to say.
Real quick, we have to pause to make fun of Tuan for a second, because at CES, there was a... So
poor Tuan.
Netflix, like, had a booth at CES, but they didn't
it's
have...
It's like a viral marketing
thing.
Yeah,
it was a viral marketing booth. Like, basically the kind of thing that you have seen, it has become commonplace at places like Comic-Con or PAX or maybe wherever, where, like, it's a full immersion, like, people in character playing the hypothetical, not hypothetical, the in-universe versions of these, the whatever the mega corporation is.
Right.
So, as you.
They're like a Tyrell corporation kind of.
Yeah, yeah. So, like in Altered Carbon, what is it that human cloning is a thing?
Yep.
And you can upload your consciousness to the cloud to then have like a backup body, something like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So, there was a booth of this company. This fictional company at CES, like pretending to be real, and Tuan definitely bought it for at least 10 minutes before he realized that it was not a real company.
Yeah, Altered Carbon's a very, like, it's like a classic noir, like, hard-boiled detective novel type book, but in a cyberpunk setting. Nice. And I think it could make for, it could like slot perfectly into the Deus Ex model.
Mm.
Like the developers of Human Revolution and Mankind Divided could probably make a pretty badass Altered Carbon game using that story.
Already I'm thinking about like systems or like where you can just enter the bodies of random folks or hijack them or something to accomplish.
It's a really interesting setup in the book, because most basically the uber rich just live for hundreds of years because real death is not a thing anymore. And so then there's a case where someone, the whole story revolves around someone trying really hard to actually murder someone and like make sure that their backup can't get uploaded. And so it's this like, you know, uber rich guy who's like 200 or 300 years old who's like, find who tried to do this to permanently kill me.
That's so pretty cool.
It's a cool premise. So.
Good answers all around. We have time for one more question. I think it's a pretty good one. RockSolid32 asks, with the recent success of Northgard and They Are Billions on Steam and the announcement of Age of Empires 4, do you think that RTS games are on the verge of a comeback? And do you think that other AAA publishers such as EA are looking at this and could start producing RTS games again, or is our only hope in indies? You guys have a clue?
I don't see RTS as coming back with AAA in any big big way.
I think the only next big AAA RTS that we might see is an eventual StarCraft III, maybe. Or I feel like that's probably more likely than a Warcraft IV, since the Warcraft lore has morphed into World of Warcraft, and that's where the story is continuing, whereas StarCraft, one of my writer friends on Twitter actually just pointed out today that we are coming up on the amount of time since StarCraft II Wings of Liberty. Basically, the time difference between
StarCraft I and StarCraft II.
Well, between Brood War and Wings of Liberty
is
now about the same amount of time between Wings of Liberty and now.
Wow.
So
Jesus.
I mean, granted, there has been the two expansion packs for that trickled out over the next like 4 years.
And honestly, those were the size of those. I feel like to Blizzard, those were essentially StarCraft 3 and 4.
Yeah, I mean, basically, yeah, they were extensions of that same story. And yeah, so like what even would be a StarCraft 3? There probably won't be a huge reinvention of mechanics. Like, the graphics haven't really improved that much more. There's not really a need for it, but other than, you know, more story.
I think it's going to mostly stay an indie thing, and then you'll see the occasional somebody like a Microsoft who goes, hey, we have this old property people really like. We think we have a good case for bringing it back. But, yeah, I think it's great that we've seen a few of these smaller games kind of find a surprisingly big, successful audience like They Are Billions, but I think it's going to continue to stay pretty small scale.
Yeah, and I think that's okay. I don't need everyone to be playing RTSs all the time. It's I still have StarCraft and all those classics to go back to if I really want to. But new ideas, please. That's going to do it for us on the show today. You can always catch us 1 p.m. Pacific time, twitch.tv/PCGamer. We also upload our videos to youtube.com/PCGamer in case you don't have time to join us live. You can also catch the audio version on iTunes, and you can find that link at PCGamer.com/tag/podcast, where we have an MP3 download and show notes and everything you need to watch the show on your own time there. And with that, until next week, keep on. What's our tagline this week? Game on.
20 great teen.
Game on. 20 great teen. Never quit gaming. Never quit gaming. Otherwise, we be shaming. Good night.
Coconut Monkey loves you.
Coconut Monkey loves you. Good night. Thanks for joining us, everyone. See you later.